Social media companies in the dock, and E. Jean Carroll hits the jackpot. We'll discuss all this more on this edition of The Editors. I'm Rich Lowry, and I'm joined, as always, by the Right Honorable Charles C.W. Cook, Madeline Maddie Kearns, and the notorious M.B.D. Michael Brendan Doherty. You are, of course, listening to a National View podcast. Our sponsors this episode are the podcast How the World Works and Bound by Oath. More about both of them in due course. If for some reason you're not already following us on a streaming service, by the way, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. And if you like what you hear here, please consider giving us a glowing five-star review on iTunes. If you don't like what you hear here, please forget I said anything. So, MBD, we had these social media hearings where Mark Zuckerberg was the star witness, and Josh Hawley, who generally I'm not a huge fan of Josh Hawley, but I think he had the most effective 5 minutes interrogating a congressional witness since Elise Stefanik and the Ivy League presidents. There's always, when you quote unquote own someone this way, there's always an element of, you know, unfairness and badgering, or there usually is, and that was present here. But he had Zuckerberg on his back foot. He was blinking and licking his lips, and then really was pressured and forced into standing up in a dramatic moment and apologizing to these parents sitting behind him of victims of various forms of online abuse. What do you make of it?
You know, it was a little unfair to Zuckerberg, as you said, but it was a dramatic moment. I mean, the stories of some of those victims are horrible. I mean, you know, it's true that, you know, some young girls have had, you know, pornographic images or just images of themselves naked, uploaded and distributed on social media. And then they take their lives out of the humiliation that that causes, or their lives are just permanently scarred by it. You know, of course, if you're asked how much child sexual abuse material is acceptable on Facebook, the answer should be zero. And that's true. It's not necessarily Mark Zuckerberg's fault that that material appeared on Facebook. And you have to, you know, I think you have to judge whether Facebook took reasonable steps to prevent that material from being uploaded and from being spread by the algorithm when it was. I think in some cases they took great steps to prevent that, and in some cases they've made mistakes. You know, this is separate from, you know, my views about Facebook more generally. So I thought it was unfair, but it was dramatic, and it illustrated, I think, a larger point, a political point, which I think is that there is a growing and emergent policy consensus on the Hill that social media is bad for teenagers and maybe should be restricted from them in a serious way. And having seen state age limit laws on pornographic sites start to actually work and be really effective, Congress has more of an appetite, I think, now to experiment with this than they ever have before, where previously it was considered a totally fruitless enterprise that, you know, kids will just figure out a way around them. Parents will help them around any regulation. Now I think at least Congress is willing itself to try. So we'll see. It was a dramatic moment, and it speaks to the way that Silicon Valley has like lost so much luster in the last decade. I mean, first with the left after Trump and Brexit, after it was decided that Silicon Valley was somehow to blame for those elections, which I don't think was fair either. Silicon Valley was just reflecting what was actually happening in the real world. And now the right's come in with, as child sex abuse has become like a huge issue on the right, and you know, they're taking the hide out of Zuckerberg now.
Yeah. So, Maddie, I think, you know, there's this constant back and forth about how many safety officers Facebook has, and there's this email from this guy, Nick Clegg, is that his name, saying, you know, I need 50 safety officers, and Zuckerberg say, no, we're not going to do that. And just to me, that seems mostly irrelevant. It's the medium of itself that is likely harmful to teens. And I say likely. Jonathan Haidt has been on this case for years now, and it's certainly, you know, there may be confounding variables or something else going on, but it certainly seems to line up pretty well with the ubiquity of social media, the rise of the ubiquity of social media, with this incredible rise in at least self-reported depression and anxiety among teenagers, especially girls, and not just self-reports. You know, there are also more suicide attempts and hospital visits for self-harm. Maybe something else is going on, but it seems likely this is the culprit or the main culprit. And I was looking at something last night. I think from kids 13 to 17, like 95% are on social media. They're, in theory, they're supposed to be a ban, so you can't get on when you're under age 13, but about 40% of 8 to 12-year-olds report being on social media as well.
Yeah, so I think this actually came up when Zuckerberg suggested that the bulk of scientific evidence does not support the idea that there's a direct causal relationship between social media use and teen mental health issues. And this was something I think Holly challenged quite effectively. And you mentioned Jonathan Haidt, and he's pointed out that part of the problem with these scientific studies that suggest there's maybe not a problem is that they define their terms so broadly. So it would be kind of like defining candy to include vegetables and saying that, like, oh yeah, if you live only on candy, or if you consume too much candy, then it's actually not harmful because you're including all these other things. Mm-hmm. I mean,
So those studies include other forms of screen, you know, watching TV.
Exactly, yeah, mm-hmm. which are not the things that people are objecting to. They're not objecting to the use of screens for educational purposes or the internet as a source of information or a source of connection. They're objecting to this, you know, unwanted sexual advances or the types of content that produces ill mental health effects. So, you know, you had the Instagram whistleblower case a while ago of, you know, it was like 37% of Instagram users between ages 13 and 15 had encountered unwanted nudity in the previous 7 days, 24% had encountered unwanted sexual advances, which again suggests that they know this is a problem, they know this is going on. And, you know, Michael says it was unfair. I don't know if it was unfair. I think it was over the top. I mean, you know, had a Senator Marsha Blackburn saying that Zuckerberg's trying to be the premier sex trafficking site in the country. That's obviously a bit overblown. Senator Lindsey Graham saying he has blood on his hands. But this is a big problem. And I think something Jonathan Haidt says a lot when people say, oh, but it's not been proven to be causal. He says, well, okay, if you look at the 2010s, you see this huge uptick in suicidality, mental health problems in teenagers. Do you have another explanation for what it could possibly be? And his critics generally don't, to be honest. They sometimes say things like, oh, well, maybe climate change or something like that. But then it's like, well, okay, but how are kids learning about climate change? How are they becoming obsessed about climate change? Could that be TikTok? Could that be, you know, social media? Most likely. I mean, my experience anecdotally of interviewing parents whose children have become or started identifying as transgender and gone down this very depressive, anxiety-ridden rabbit hole is that the social media has a huge role to play. These are often isolated kids, vulnerable kids. They end up finding this like online community, some of whom are adults, that having sort of these cyber relationships that wouldn't have existed in any other context. And, you know, you could make the argument that, okay, but it's up to parents to police that. And if parents want to decide that they can't have phones, then they have that power. But, you know, not everybody actually does have that power. I was thinking of one parent I interviewed whose daughter had decided she was really a boy and then ultimately took her own life. And social media had a huge part to play in her story. But this woman was an immigrant. She was a single mom. She had four kids. She had no choice but to send her daughter to public school, where all the peers are also very online. And you do think, like, could somebody like that benefit from regulation, which takes this mm-hmm. product that's suspected, very strongly suspected to be dangerous for kids, for teenagers, and makes it a little bit harder for them to access it? And I think probably yes, probably mm-hmm. the government could help.
Yeah, parents of teens just always say it's so hard because all the other teenagers are on it. Charlie?
I think that this was a repellent example of cynical, tech illiterate, populist demagoguery. And that Josh Hawley should be ashamed of himself. I do. I think this was an example of problems that are the product of irrepressible technological change being blamed on the people who designed the core systems that undergird those changes rather than those who abuse them or who are responsible for monitoring abuse. Now, I have no doubt that social media is bad for kids. We can stipulate that. I don't think that's the question here, though. I personally work hard to keep my kids away from social media. I've locked down the family computer and their devices, the Apple TV. But I don't think the problem here is Mark Zuckerberg or Elon Musk or Sergey Brin or anyone in that mold. I read an AP story yesterday, which starts like this. Just bring this up. Sexual predators, addictive features, suicide and eating disorders, unrealistic beauty standards, bullying. These are just some of the issues young people are dealing with on social media, and children's advocates and lawmakers say companies are not doing enough to protect them. It's the last sentence there that's the problem, not doing enough to protect them. The AP story has a quote from Dick Durbin, senator from Illinois, a Democrat. They are responsible for many of the dangers our children face online. Their design choices, their failures to adequately invest in trust and safety, their constant pursuit of engagement and profit over basic safety have all put our kids and grandkids at risk. I just don't think that's true. I'm sure it helps the career of Josh Hawley to ask whether or not he's personally compensated the families, whether he apologizes. But this is not a design choice so much as it's a result of the way the internet works, which in America is extremely open. And the thing is, Americans want to keep it that way. The moment companies start spying, people get angry. The moment companies start deciding what can and can't be said, you see a backlash, often from the same people involved in this circus act. The other case against big tech that I hear all the time is it's intrusive. Barack Obama was killed in the polls, I think quite rightly, for the metadata inspection. Americans don't like the negative consequences of social media, and I don't either. But they also hate any of the things that we would need to do to fix it. So what do? Instead of having a serious conversation about those trade-offs, we put Mark Zuckerberg in front of Congress and pretend that these issues are the product of choices that he has made to make more money. And it's just not true.
All right, so MBD, instead of asking you directly to tangle with Charlie, I'm going to ask the exit question, which will have great implications for the different views of this matter. And that question is, if you're in Congress and a bill was advanced, maybe you'd draft it. Maybe I should ask whether you'd draft it. But I'm just going to ask whether you'd vote for it if someone else drafted it. A ban on kids under age 18 using social media. And let's stipulate it's an intelligently written bill. It's what Yuval Levin and others have set out. You'd have real age verification. You'd have real teeth in the bill and punishment for companies working around it. And you'd have an opt-in for parents who really want their kids to be on social media when they're younger than age 18. Would you vote for that bill?
I think usually they've been framed as at 16, which I would support. 18 feels a little bit dramatic. you know, I understand it fits with other age of majority lines already, but if you can drive, I think if you can drive a, you know, 2-ton vehicle, you can have an Instagram account. That's at the age of 16.
All right. So you offer an amendment to do it at 16, Maddie.
Yeah, at 16, I think I would vote for that.
Charlie, assume you're a no.
Well, I'm a no, not because I don't think that there is a bright line to be drawn between minors and adults. I am a classical liberal who leans libertarian when it comes to the rights and responsibilities of adults. I don't extend that to children. I am a no because there is no technological way to achieve that without materially damaging the internet and access to it for everyone. I don't want to see those powers being granted to Congress.
So how would such in theory there's a ban at age 13. It is not, you know, it's kind of meaningless. But why would a ban at 16 or 18 materially harm the rest of the internet?
Well, because for everyone else? The way that you would verify the age of potential social media users would apply to everyone by definition. The computer doesn't know how old you are. It's not as if it scans your face, heaven forfend, and determines how old you are. So a 50-year-old would be subject to the same restrictions as an 8-year-old. That's how it would work. If you look back to the creation of the internet and then the World Wide Web, the whole point in it is that the backbone systems, DNS, HTML, HTTP, and HTTPS, are accessible to anyone. You can quite literally plug a computer into your home internet connection, route a domain name to the IP address, install a server of some sort on that machine, and share your thoughts or whatever it is with the world. The moment we start getting into this territory, we're determining which websites are and are not subject to age verification, which is draconian regulation, and we are making everyone who engages with some of the most popular sites in the world give their personal information over. The only way you could do this is to have it reviewed, much as you have to when you open a bank account. I can see the case for it in banking. I think on the internet, that's a disaster. It's also a security nightmare because that has to be stored, at least temporarily, somewhere. This would materially change the way the internet works. I'm not denying that there is a problem here. I just think this so-called solution is a sea change that people ought to think much more carefully about. And I do think that this question is really one that ought to be posed to parents and hopefully fixed with free market solutions where parents are made much more aware of the dangers that their children face and they are therefore expected to monitor their use more closely themselves or install software on their devices to do that, not at the central level mandated by law.
So I just want to jump in just on two things, Charlie. I agree with you. I do want to see more products offered to parents. You and I know how to, you know, run a home server and block access, you know, at the home level to a lot of, you know, unsavory content. I'd love to see products that made it easier to do that on a cell phone that's just connecting to the local, you know, 5G network, make that easier for parents to do on their kids' phones when they're teenagers. But I'm curious about these laws in Utah and Arkansas that have been passed on pornography sites that require users to give a legal ID. And it drove MindGeek, you know, one of the biggest sites on the internet, you're right, to block access in some of those states. In the case of pornography, I mean, the fact that there's a security issue that MindGeek would hold the personal ID, I mean, that's a, it's almost like an enhancing feature of the law, an enhancing way of dissuading people from using these sites that are socially destructive. So, I mean, I think that's why these things are coming up, because there's, at least for now, Arkansas's legislators seem happy with the results they've had on...
Sure. And they fundamentally changed the internet in those states. I'm not suggesting that you can't do it. You could also cut access to the internet in Utah and Arkansas, and that would work too. But it would change the way that our information flows in the United States. And I think we ought to be extremely skeptical toward that.
No, I mean, I agree with you. I mean, I think there's been, you know, there's a lot of deep thought on this now because... You know, China has its own lockdown internet. Russia kind of has its own internet world. It's almost like they're we're dividing the internet into, 1984's civilizational spheres.
Even Europe, how it's governed. Even Europe, the United States is an outlier once again.
Right, and like I support in some ways, like my old friend James Poulos advocates for a Second Amendment to compute. Like a right for Americans to use computer technology and not just to and use it themselves, not just have large companies use it for them as mediators. But I think, you know, I think you can do age regulations on these things legally. And I don't know if it totally disrupts the internet to do that.
So I would vote for such a thing pretty much without hesitation. Charlie's created some hesitation, but assuming that the age verification can be done in some plausible way, Yuval and this guy Chris Griswold, who wrote a big piece for National Affairs on this, have an idea involving the Social Security Administration, where the companies would just it would get the age verification. I don't know whether that's actually workable. They think it is, but I just think this is kind of out of control for parents, and they need something that tips the balance more in their favor. And I'm enough of a libertarian to say they should be able to opt into it and get their kids on Instagram at age 15 if they want to, but the norm should be no. And I just think this is a vast psychological and emotional experience that's been, through no one's volition, really, been visited upon our teenagers, and the outcome has not been healthy. And we find if 10 years from now the mental health crisis was driven by something else, you know, let's get the 15-year-olds back on Instagram. But I just think the loss to teenagers of not being on Instagram or TikTok and Snapchat, it's not like we're denying them, you know, the collected volumes of Shakespeare. It's they 10 years ago or so, they're perfectly fine and more fine, in fact, without this. And I think they'd be fine without it again. At least let's run that experiment.
Well, and then when it turns out that children who want to bully one another stop using Facebook and Instagram and instead just send their harsh words or photographs via email or via text message, are we going to start locking that down as well? Or perhaps we could have Washington, D.C. super intense Minecraft where people talk to one another, or Call of Duty. I mean, there's just no way of preventing the transfer of information across the internet between people who wish to talk to each other. And I see no limiting principle here whatsoever that wouldn't turn the internet into this walled off environment in which to get so much as a Gmail account, you have to put in an ID.
But Charlie, you know, you could have, I don't think it is this limitless thing. I mean, the technologies themselves suggest how they'd be used. I mean, it is true that like I could technically set up a multi-party phone call on which, you know, and then call someone in class and say, "You're fat," in front of 28 other people on the phone call. But nobody really ever did that for, because it takes extraordinarily.
Well, they did it in school. I mean,
there's been bullying since time immemorial. It's just the evidence is that this form of media is amplifies it. It's addictive. It drives obsessions and insecurities. So that's why, you know, I think if you do the slippery slip argument, why are we stopping kids from seeing R-rated movies? You know, why do we want to stop them from seeing
pornography? I don't understand how that's possibly a slippery slope argument from what I'm saying.
But why not?
Because if you give a child a phone, they by definition have a connection to other people. There are a million ways by which other people can convey information to them. That's not an analog of going into a movie theater when you're underage. I don't understand how those two things are connected.
But the principle that we try to keep children from certain activities and content that are appropriate for adults is one that's
the principle
well established.
I agree. I conceded the principle at the start. The principle is that minors should be treated differently than adults. I agree. I don't think there are very many.
So is it just a practical concern that it'd be impossible to do it in a way? So
it's difficult.
You could do this without changing the internet. Would you do it? I guess.
But you can't. That's like saying, well, you know, if you could put a camera in every house to stop domestic violence without impinging on people's privacy, would you do it? That isn't possible. Mm-hmm. What I am saying is not that it is impossible to lock down the internet in this way, although there will be lots of ways around it. But you will raise the cost of using certain sites, of course. But I am saying that doing this fundamentally changes the character of the internet, because if you have conceded the premise that everyone, not just minors, and that's of course how this has to work, that everyone, if they are to use a service that the government either believes is inappropriate for minors or could be used for bullying, that everyone has to put in verification, whether that's a ID or a credit card or a social security number or whatever, then you have changed the way that the vast majority of websites, which are by definition, or services, definition used to move information around, work. I don't know the exact list of what it is, but I would propose that the most visited websites in the world have to be, you know, TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, Gmail,
MindGeek.
You know, whatever these are, they're going to be the most visited. You are changing an enormous amount of web traffic. You're also Go on.
So if it became more difficult for adults to get on Instagram, that also doesn't seem like a huge price.
If you believe that the purpose of the internet is to be open and free of government control, and that it is a problem when information is interdicted or superintended by Congress, then it's a pretty massive problem, yeah.
Charlie, just two other questions, not particularly hostile. One, do you think that the demand for that being expressed here for some kind of control or protection for children, do you think it could lead to an age verification system based on technology that like Apple uses with Apple Pay, where there's anonymized tokens that verify, you know, without necessarily compromising your identity the whole way through?
I'm sure that there would be a nice, neat, minimally invasive technological way of doing it, but it wouldn't change the fact that you are altering the free and open web. And look, I'm a tech hippie in this regard. I'm not as old as those who agree with me on this usually, but I had a modem when I was 9. I put up my first website when I was 10. I remember what the internet was like in 1994, and it was glorious. And over time, two things have happened, both of which I find distasteful, only one of which I think is the role of government to avoid. The first one is that we have seen massive centralization, but that has largely been the product of consumer choice. People seem to want to have centralized email systems, for example. The popularity of Gmail or Yahoo are good examples of that. I personally like the decentralized internet. Most people don't. Fair enough. That's consumer choice. The second is the tendency towards this sort of lockdown temptation, which we've seen grow obviously in totalitarian states and to a lesser extent in Europe, and we're now seeing pop up in America. And I would predict that I am going to lose this, that we are going to see a fundamental change in the way that the internet works that people will profoundly regret. And by the time they regret it, it will be too late.
All right, so let's move on before we blow up the whole podcast with this and hear from our first sponsor this episode. Our friends at the Competitive Enterprise Institute are back with new episodes of their breakout How the World Works podcast, hosted by author and political commentator Kevin Williamson. If you're not already listening to the show, each episode, Kevin sits down with notable guests for candid conversations about the jobs they've had and the role of work in the economy and our social lives, from flipping burgers and tending pigs on a farm to leading special ops missions in far corners of the globe. Some of America's best thinkers discuss the jobs they've had that informed their outlook on life and future careers. In a recent episode, Kevin sat down with Jonah Goldberg, both of whom, of course, are old friends and colleagues of us here at NR, for a fascinating conversation about the ins and outs of Jonah's decades-long career in the media. So be sure to listen to How the World Works wherever you listen to podcasts, or visit cei.org/howtheworldworks. That's cei.org/howtheworldworks. So, Maddie, we had a big verdict the other day in this E. Jean Carroll defamation case. This is the second trial and the second one that Trump has lost. He lost initially a trial about whether he was guilty in a civil sense of this alleged sexual assault that happened sometime about 30 years ago. E. Jean Carroll cannot remember what year it was, supposedly in a dressing room in Bergdorf's, a huge department store on Fifth Avenue. And Trump has continually denied this and called E. Jean Carroll all sorts of names, which created this defamation suit. And although the penalty in the initial trial was $5 million for the sexual assault, this jury went way out there and said the damages for the defamation is much, much more than that, $83.3 million. What do you make of it?
Yeah, so we typically think sticks and stones may break my bones, but words can never hurt me. But in this case, words are apparently 16 times more damaging than even sexual assault. So it really is a absolutely whopping figure. I mean, funnily enough, Trump's problem, which is lack of self-restraint and inability to shut his mouth, basically, it seems to be the same problem that oftentimes his enemies have. And I think that while obviously he was effectively muzzled in this second trial by the judge, but in the first trial and before the first trial, he obviously didn't show up to the first trial, but before that he was running off his mouth multiple times, running the risk that there was going to be lawsuits for defamation, and that's obviously exactly what happened. But I do think since this most recent verdict, really it's possibly E. Jean Carroll who's been showing up a little too much and running her mouth. I mean, the media tour I don't think has done her any favors.
Offering to take Rachel Maddow ship of fishing in France.
Yeah, very strange. I mean, she's kind of an eccentric person. We know that already. There was that 2019 interview she did with Anderson Cooper and made him sort of visibly cringe when she suggested that rape is most people think of rape as something sexy. And she's talked about this with a degree of flippancy that would not have been used to persuade a jury, and therefore really is not advisable when trying to persuade the court of public opinion. So, I mean, Trump seems to have so far kind of been reined in a bit by this figure, and has so far kept his mouth shut, has indicated that he intends to appeal, and as Andy McCarthy has suggested or implied, he could have a decent shot of that. I mean, the evidence to convict, obviously this was a civil case, but the evidence against him was underwhelming, not least because E. Jean Carroll can't remember the specifics of when this happened. So yeah, I mean, we'll see how he gets on with the appeal, but he just has to keep a tight lip from now on if he wants to not avoid more more defamation cases.
Yeah, so MBD, you know, it's really impossible to know what happened 30 years ago. You wouldn't put necessarily anything past Trump, although this does not really fit his pattern. His pattern, which was not good, was groping, kissing, unwanted, you know, sudden kisses in an elevator, that kind of thing, and ogling the girls in the dressing room for his various beauty contests. But, you know, this obviously he didn't show up for the first trial, and then he gets the guilty verdict locked in there, and then he, you know, inveighs against it, and because that first verdict's already locked in, in part, who knows, you know, may have gone the same way even if he showed up, but in part because he blew it off, then he can't, you know, bring up whether he's guilty or not in this trial, and the jury didn't like him very much, clearly.
No, they didn't. And, you know, this is what I think this is what the system in New York was designed to do to him in a way, with his political unpopularity. It was easy to get a jury that could agree to a crazy number like this. Also, you know, there's real questions about the competence of Trump's counsel, right? I mean, he's obviously letting go of Alina, who represented him in this trial, as he moves on towards an appeal phase.
He had a pretty good lawyer in the first one.
Yeah.
Takapina.
Takapina is a great lawyer, but Trump's had problems keeping counsel because he has a tendency not to pay them on time. And he's going to have trouble getting counsel unless they secure money in cash in advance. You know, he has a reputation and he has a ton of lawsuits to deal with. I mean, we're talking about, you know, several felonies and what, 90. I mean, we're now that the verdicts are coming in, we're lowering the number of charges altogether, but still has about 80 charges left. This has been bad for him, at least on the level of, you know, soaking up time, attention, and monetary resources that he would otherwise put into campaigning for president. Obviously, like, the legal persecution measurably helped him in the Republican primary. But I think it's a total drag on him as a general election candidate, because he has to win moderates, and a lot of moderate voters who probably voted for Trump in 2016 are going to look and see, like, this guy is in a constant legal mess now, and is not, you know, no longer has the image of, like, world beating entrepreneur and, you know, business mogul and TV star. You know, there's a lot more to his image now. Yeah, this legal trouble is not helping him, even if it looks vindictive.
So I'm going to ask an extra question about the Lawfare campaign against Trump and how it's playing politically. But Charlie, any gut instincts on the merits of this charge, underlying charge and defamation case against Trump?
I'm not entirely sure. I do think that the punishment is excessive. There seems to be a trend. I know the appeals processes often whittle down the millions or hundreds of millions, in one case, billions of dollars that are owed. I find this a tough one to talk about because it's not clean or neat. It is probably true that this case got as far as it did because Donald Trump is involved. It is probably true that the damages were excessive. It is also not an accident or a coincidence that Donald Trump keeps finding himself in these positions. There's this argument you see on the right: whomever we nominate or elevate, they'll go after. Well, yeah, to some extent. But they can't fabricate to this extent the opportunities that they have to persecute. And It seems to me likely that there is something here, albeit probably not as much as was determined and then punished in that civil trial.
Next question to you, Maddie Kearns. First, the Lawfare campaign against Donald Trump is now clearly having already a political effect and working. Yes or no?
Yes.
MBD.
Yeah, absolutely. It's draining resources and repelling moderates, and even as it further secures him at the top of the Republican Party.
Charlie.
Yeah, it's draining resources, and it's the worst sort of gaffe, I use that broadly, in that it confirms people's pre-existing conceptions, negative conceptions, of the person in question.
Yep, it's as we saw in these FEC reports, it is draining resources. Obviously, it's draining time and attention. That hasn't hurt him in the primaries, actually helped him, but that won't necessarily hold true in the general election. And just, you know, being entangled in this dispute with this woman, it can't in any way help him with one of his major demographic vulnerabilities in the fall, which is his standing with women. With that, let's hear from our second sponsor this episode. The world would be a better, freer, and happier place if constitutional protections for private property were taken just a tad more seriously. That's according to our friends over at the Institute for Justice, who have just begun releasing a new season of their legal history podcast, Bound by Oath. Bound by Oath tells the story of how the Supreme Court has cleared the way for government officials to abuse property rights, to trespass on private land without a warrant, to restrict peaceful and productive uses of property, to seize and keep property without sufficient justification, and much more. Featuring interviews not only with scholars and litigators, but also with the real-life people behind some of the Supreme Court's most momentous property rights decisions, the new season explores the history behind today's civil rights battle. So plug Bound by Oath into wherever you get your podcasts and start with episode one. That's Bound by Oath. Please check it out. So since we ran a little long with the discussion of social media, I'm just going to go exit question right off the bat with our third topic here, which is these DOJ prosecutions of these pro-life activists in Tennessee under what is called the FACE Act, Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances Act. The punishment for what was a peaceful protest seems wildly out of proportion, but that gets to the merits of this exit question to you first. Maddie, rate your level of outrage at these prosecutions from 0. Doesn't really bother you. This is the law, how the system works. 10. This is a shame and a disgrace.
It's an 8 or 9. I mean, I think we put it well in our editorial where we just said that they're using this category, legal category of obstruction, very broadly. So in the Tennessee case, the pro-lifers were in front of the door, but nobody tried to enter the door. And so we don't know whether they would have stopped people from entering the door. This is in this, similar to how the law is cynically used in the United Kingdom and I think other places in Europe, where harassment is so broadly defined to include people who are standing praying outside an abortion clinic. It's also infuriating because of the double standard. So not long ago in a recent episode of this podcast, we were talking about the pro-Palestinian protesters who blocked a major bridge in New York City or have blocked access to airports. And you don't see them being prosecuted with this level of ferocity. And so it is outrageous.
Emily?
Yeah, it's about a 9. I mean, it really reminds me it's the new version of the Clinton administration using RICO to go after pro-life protesters, which they did in the 1990s. This is an abuse of the law. They're wildly conflating. They're conflating being in front of a clinic with obstructing an entrance to a clinic, and then throwing the book at grandmothers who are, you know, silently praying or singing hymns. It's totally abusive. And they've all but admitted, I mean, the assistant attorney general admitted basically that this was retaliation for the fall of Roe. So it's totally out of line.
Charlie?
Yeah, it's preposterous Calvin ball. When they like a given protest or even riot, we're told that the First Amendment is at stake, that violence even is the language of the unheard. And we're asked what those who conduct it are supposed to do when they stand alone against Goliath. And then when it's pro-lifers, they're prosecuted for obstruction. It's Calvin ball.
Yeah, I'm with everyone else. It's way up there. 8, 9, 10 territory with that. Let me pause, do a quick plug for NR Plus digital subscription service at nationalreview.com. If you liked the discussion earlier on social media, and we find generally what people like most about this podcast is forceful disagreement, I would urge you to sign up for NR Plus. Debate is one of the great aspects of NR. We are not afraid of it. We have a lot of sincere, intelligent people who enjoy debate, think it's fun for one, but two, really believe in ideas and think that the clash of ideas is clarifying and helps to work our way towards the truth. So every time we have a disagreement like that on the podcast, you're getting like a little window to what a lot of editorial meetings are about. And I submit to you, there are not many publications that embrace debate the way National Review does. So that's just one of many reasons to sign up for NR Plus. So if you're not already a member, please consider joining tens of thousands of your fellow National Review readers as a member of NR Plus. Let's hit a few other things before we go. MBD, you've been reading a commentary on the Gospel of Mark.
Yeah, I've been really taken by a book called Loosing the Lion by a professor, Dr. Leroy Zenga, and it's just a very great commentary on the Gospel of Mark, which is the short gospel, and which was largely denigrated by biblical scholars for many years, saying it was just an unstrung set of pearls. But Zenga shows that I think very conclusively in his book that if you use just normal literary methods of analyzing the gospel, plot, conflict, resolution, etc., its theological depth is really revealed, and it's just great to see this kind of recovery of this kind of scholarship after about a century and a half of bullshit. Frankly.
So, Maddie, you hosted a Robert Burns supper, raising the question, what is a Robert Burns supper?
Yeah, so you Americans obviously have a lot of public holidays. You have July 4th and President's Day and a lot of others. In Scotland, we have St. Andrew's Day, which is November 30th. And then we also have the commemoration of our national poet on January 25th. So Robert Burns is born January 25th, 1759. And you may know him from Auld Lang Syne. He wrote that. And he also wrote a bunch of other things. So we invite people around and we had a lot of whiskey and people, all of our guests, except one who was English, were American. So they all had to go at reciting poems in the Scots dialect, which was a lot of fun. And we served haggis pizza. So it wasn't real haggis. Can't get real haggis here. FDA frowns upon it. So we did a sort of like ground lamb with oats and spices and served it as a pizza topping with whiskey sauce. So yeah, it was great, great fun evening. And just leaning into the Scottishness of it all.
So Charlie, you're not just an internet hippie. You might be a hippie generally because you guys have been raising butterflies.
That's right. This was a birthday present for my 6-year-old for his 6th birthday. The company that sent the kits, essentially send you a bunch of caterpillars, sent 2 batches by accident. And you can't really send caterpillars back. So we had a whole bunch in this big net and we've been raising them and then they go into their cocoons. And now they're starting to come out. And in dribs and drabs, they fly off. We take them outside and open the net at the top. So we have 8 left. 2 have gone out into the broader world. I think the best part is that my six-year-old named each of them after a Jacksonville Jaguars player and somehow managed to remember which was which. So I would suddenly hear, you know, oh, Zay Jones is flying around. Oh, look at Trevor Lawrence. He's coming out of the cocoon.
Awesome. So I mentioned Masters of the Air last ep. I listened to a number of podcasts now with the screenwriter and one last night at School of War, which I'm a big fan of. I mentioned before with Donald Miller, who wrote the book Masters of Air, that the series is loosely based on. And this guy is just, if you're all interested in World War II or aviation, you got to listen to this podcast. And I was joking with Aaron, I'm a little bit of a texting buddy with Aaron, that Aaron asked like two questions, I think, the first 25 minutes. This guy just talks. And, you know, sometimes someone who just talks, they could be the drone and you're done, you can't handle it. But everything he said was absolutely fascinating. Obviously knows his subject backwards and forwards. With that, it's time for our editor's picks. MBD, what's your pick?
My pick, this is so weird. I wrote earlier in the week that I was getting tired of Taylor Swift talk, but I really liked Dan McLaughlin's piece on why Taylor Swift is reaching her zenith of popularity now, because it was just such a competent and thoughtful dive into the dynamics of pop culture and how, you know, why particularly the pandemic and other events are kind of driving this insane demand for tickets to her concerts now, and the broadness of her appeal. And I just thought it was really just a really sharp bit of pop culture analysis.
Yeah, the whole Taylor Swift thing was like a classic 36-hour news cycle, right? It's like it was all anyone could talk about for 36 hours, and then you know, 6 hours after that, you're like, this is old news. But Dan is just so good at so many levels of providing a comprehensive and authoritative take on things. Maddie Kearns, what's your pick?
My pick's actually your piece, Rich. Kids shouldn't be on social media at all.
No, don't raise this again, Maddie. We got to end this podcast sometime soon.
I was going to say, Charlie speaks very persuasively and raised a number of points that I now want to go away and research to defend or I'm open to being, you know, that there isn't a
defense. I know. We're all dug into our positions.
But I will say that there's something on an instinctual level where I was reading your piece and I was like, yes. You know, if I had it printed out, I would have written yes.
So. Thank you. Written yes in red ink.
Yes, of course.
Charlie, what's your pick?
I'll confess this is partly because the headline made me laugh, but Noah Rothman's post, "They'll Never See It Coming," which contains a description of Joe Biden's vacillating and announcing that he has called a committee to form a committee to decide what to do in Iran, is a great pithy little explanation of why if you're going to act on the world stage, you have to do it. You can't talk about it for a week beforehand. And if you do that, it ends up making you less safe than you would have been if you'd never acted at all.
So my pick is by our own Sarah Schutte, who wrote one of these kind of Americana lifestyle type essays we feature in the new monthly magazine. Charlie inaugurated this by scamming their editorial process to get a trip over to London to watch the Jaguars play with his dad. And Sarah has used it to write about her flying career, including opening with a landing that nearly made her cry. So what had you so upset, Sarah?
Oh my gosh, it was awful. The whole flight had just been really bad. I had been bumped all over the place. There was some turbulence. I couldn't hold my altitude correctly. And then we came back in to land and he was like, "You have to get these landings." And I was like, "I know." And I was trying to, I can't remember where I was, which levee I was over top of, because the runway has two ends, which is the way the wind was that day. We were coming in and I was like, okay, I'm going to nail this spot. And I just slammed the plane down onto the pavement. It was so bad. I cannot believe the nose wheel didn't collapse.
Yeah, it's usually a bad sign when your pilot is at the brink of tears.
Yeah, well, I didn't cry. I actually never cried the entire time. I didn't cry at any point when I was flying, at any point during all of the studying I did. I was really proud of this fact. So Awesome. I was very stoic about that.
Well, congratulations on the piece. So that's it for us. You've been listening to a National View podcast. Any rebroadcast, retransmission, or account of this game without the express written permission of National View Magazine is strictly prohibited. This podcast has been produced by the aforementioned incomparable Sarah Schutte, who makes it sound better than we deserve. Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Maddie. Thank you, MBD. Thanks to How the World Works and Bound by Oath. And thanks especially to all of you for listening. We're the editors. We'll see you next time.